Accession of 11938, reel 34.
Mr. G. Eyston, reel 34. What results on your way of living and the way in which you had to contend with the conditions was this retreat situation having upon you?
Well, I suppose that by this time everything was more or less automatic. Well, an automatic pilot, as you might say. Jobs were done when we didn't realise we were doing them, probably. And I think we're so tired that for the period after the El Razus escapade, where we shot up by the tanks, apart from a few incidents, I'm quite blank. This is probably pure fatigue, because there was no rest at all for a considerable period. And I would take it that the jobs that had to be done, for instance, if somebody broke down, I suppose we went to it and we did it. But it hasn't registered, because it was just working up automatic powers. We're doing the things automatically. I do remember carrying George Adams with somebody else, I can't even remember who the somebody else was, round the headland in the sea until we got back, I suppose, some 2 miles further on into a safe area, and we got back on land. And then we got him to Brook. And I can remember him with this other person. He had his arms around both our necks, and we carried him into the hospital. The hospital was a little white building. Well, all the buildings in Tobruk are white, or they were white before they were shot about, but they were all white buildings. And this was probably a little school, or it could even have been a little Italian hospital. But I remember we took them through the door and were chased out immediately to make room for somebody else coming in. It was so bad. And we left George Adams there, and that was the last I can remember seeing of George. And then we went down sort of trying to find out what had happened to the rest of the battalion, our rear party, the Major Ferns. And I remember nobody was really interested in us at all, and nobody gave us any details. I remember that. And then we went down somewhere to a blue lagoon. Now, something about this blue lagoon, it's quite clear even now. I mean, it wasn't in the harbour, obviously, because the harbour was a filthy mess of rusted shipping, landing craft and all sorts of rubbish in the harbour, and a real mucky, muddy mess. But further down on the coast, on the sort of the south-east out of Tobruk, past the nets, the shipping nets, sort of out of the harbour altogether, there was a blue lagoon. And I can remember sitting down there, possibly about five of us, and I think we went to sleep, to be quite honest, for a few minutes. And when we came to, we were thinking about having a swim in this lagoon, but there's something about it. It was either an officer's camp for a rest camp, or it was Navy. I can't just remember. Anyway, it was out of bounds as far as we could tell. So we didn't get our swim at all. And then, I don't know how we got to Bertolata. I can't remember seeing Major Ferns, and he's the man I should have been with, if it was possible. But obviously I got a vehicle, because I was told that I arrived at Bertolata with a load of beer and whiskey on the back. And that must have come from the big naffy on the top of the bank at Tobruk on the coast road. I was told I arrived in the camp with this. And really speaking, that's all I can say about Bertolata. It's just one of those things that that aren't there. But I do remember I'm going thinking about this swim in the harbour, but it was out of bounds. Now, out would be out of bounds in that sort of situation, where you've got a wall going around you, and Well, there's obvious quarters they're not, but it's still the soldier's instinct, I suppose, that you just, you took this. But while we're leaving Tobruk, we did learn that we're going to go back to Merzimah True, thinking that we're going to form a line down the border, down the Egyptian border. We got back to Mirza.
You don't recall much of the journey?
I can't, no. No, I'm very sketchy about that. The events in Mirza, we must have gone to Mirza as a battalion, somehow, from Bertolata. We must have gone back up to Mirza. Bertolata is, oh, what, some 60 miles, I think, south of Tobruk. And then Merzimah True was sort of 60, 80 miles northeast of Bertolata. So we did a big circle out of Tobruk and then back onto the coast at Merzimah True. And I don't remember going through Merzimah True because it was the first time I'd actually been. Sorry, no, it wasn't. I'd seen the plains. Well, it was the first time I'd been in the village itself because Merzimah True, the coast road sort of goes on the escarpment, and then the village is a bit like, well, in quote, one is Robin Hood's Bay, you know, it's that sort of place. You go down a steep winding road and get down into the village in the bottom. So you very seldom went into these coastal villages, really, because the coast road went across the top, and the village was away down the winding track. So in this particular time, I did go through Merzimah True, so whether there was a purpose for that, I don't know. Because I can remember seeing the ship at Mirza, which was desalinating the water. And she was puffing away like mad at that time. And I do remember seeing this. The water wasn't still a fair amount of salt, did it? But I do remember seeing that on the go. So we got ourselves settled on the escarpment. Well, the troops on the escarpment, sort of, south east of Merzimah True from the village. I contradict myself a little bit. The road actually goes down the escarpment, and we were sort of on the road and waiting for the enemy to come round. And he did try to do a similar thing to the one at Tobruk, where he went east and then went back northwest and broke into Tobruk. And he tried to do the same thing at Merzimah True. And there were a number of severe battles. The 9th Battalion got severely, in fact, they were nearly wiped out at Merzimah True. We had one or two skirmishes.
Were you dug in?
Yes, oh yes. In fact, we did, I think it was four or maybe five moves from Tolada, all in the area of the frontier, until we finally got to this one at Merzimah True. In fact, we'd been in the place that Miga Guam, where Rommel did his attack from. We'd already done a place there and moved out of it. So whether that was sort of part of the retreat or strengthening the defence, you know what, I don't really know. But the 10th Indian Division were in Merzimah True itself, or in the perimeter of Merzimah True. And we went in and we sort of dug all the way down the escarpment. And we held Brommel. The 9th Battalion got overrun, but the line still held. I think we shoved a company out to one side. And then we withdrew a little bit to the west, and the 8th Battalion came in alongside us.
What was your involvement in this?
Well, this, I was off the escarpment. We were down below the escarpment, except for two occasions, I think, where I had to go up and look at one of the portees, because the anti-tank guns were having a severe time. And but most of the time was below the escarpment.
It happened at this time because of the situation, being in the situation of actually becoming a rifleman yourself?
No. In fact, it never happened to me. Apart from when we landed in Sicily, I think that was the only time that I really went as a... And then I didn't go as a rifleman because I had a job to do on the landing beaches. But I was carrying a rifle again at that time because after the affair at Arras and again at Gazala, I found the rifle was awkward because it meant that if I was going out to work anywhere, or maybe, you see, they might just drop me off my truck and I would carry on, as I explained, squirting petrol into the cans. Well, I couldn't take a rifle with me every time I was doing this because I had a toolbox and petrol, the old can and all the rest of it. So I did eventually finish up with a revolver, a 38 revolver. So the rifle didn't... I never really got involved as a rifleman. But later on the... Rommel did his attack. And then on the... I think it was the 27th of June. We did an escape, a similar thing to Gazala, except that we left a party on the escarpment, and that party was made up a lot with the clerks and the batmen, cooks, stretcher bearers. Well, the stretcher bearers and rifles, but there was quite a few of them there in the line. And that was sort of a company, a lot of surplus of the S company, the anti-tank and the mortars and the those who had lost carriers. They were left behind to form a defence on the escarpment. And the rest of the battalion moved out in two columns, in our normal form. We went to go up the wadi. I think we went up two wadis, in fact. And the wadis were very steep, going up the escarpment. Then we went through this defence line, made up of the cooks and all the rest of them. And on the top, we formed up into a... similar to a jock column, but with different things in it, because we left some artillery behind and we had some artillery with us, and we had some RA anti-tank, we had our own anti-tank and the carriers on the side and then the companies down the side. Plus the second Cheshires, they went with us. So we took out more or less two jock columns out of this and we ran into some heavy fixed lines.
Was this during the day or at
this night? Was night. We left about 8 o'clock at night. Just on dusk, I think it was.
What was the aim? Dusk was 8 o'clock. Was there a target for you? Did you know what you were doing?
Yes and no. We were breaking out, to all intents and purposes. And we went through all this fire and... The crossfire was really bad. There was 88s on fixed lines, and I mean, they were just, once they got a light, you see, they could swing around and fire, and they could see after that. I mean, once you got a vehicle on fire, the shadow is all over the place, and a vehicle's moving through. You've got to go past it. It's like they're only silhouettes, really, going past. But they do shine up pretty well, and of course that was a good thing for the 88s because they could line up on the fire, and as soon as somebody got a nose in front of between the 88 and the fire, I mean, that was shot. So it was really nasty. Apart from that, there was machine gun fire and the anti-tanks and all sorts. And I think it was on that one where Roy Hall... No, the carrier commander... The OC carriers. His carrier got hit and Roy went to assist him. And while he was doing that, Roy's carrier got hit and Roy himself got hit. We're quite a nasty duo over this one. In fact, the 88s, you see, you get it two bursts of this, you can hear it leave and then you can see it land. So you get a double thing, because the 88, I think I did say before, the 88 has a double bang. It's sort of got a the blast, and then there's a bang from the recoil, because it's a big recoil system on the top of the gun. And so you hear this double bang. You know what it is that's coming. So it's really frightening. And we went out, I don't know how far we travelled, but we travelled till early next morning. And the early next morning, we were going back down the same way we came out of, back to where we started. We went through all this defence company that we'd left, and back down into the plain between the sea and the escarpment. Now, we're told at this stage that that night's escapade had been to get the 10th Indian Division out of Mersey Matruh. How successful that was, I don't really know.
To get the German attention.
It was to hold the Germans so that they were concentrating on us while the others did a silent march out, I suppose. Man, we started silent. We didn't use any artillery at that stage. And I suppose, really speaking, it was to cause a diversion while the Indian Division got out. But it's not a very nice feeling when you think you've been out through all this fire, spent the night driving around the desert. And the Germans had left one or two minefields, which we weren't very thrilled about. Well, we weren't thrilled because they weren't marked. And that caused some problem. And then, of course, to get back to just where we left, just like it was a Gazala for Mickey Ferns and myself, and the same thing again, because I was with Mickey's rear party again. Mickey was left with the rear party to go through this thing. And I don't honestly remember seeing him anymore after that. I might have done.
Did you at any time get involved with your work during this movement?
Well, not very much, because it was also there was so much going on, and if it was hit, it was on fire. So really speaking, there wasn't much I could do apart from picking the odd stragglers up. And we did pick quite a few stragglers, as we'd done all the way from Gazala. We'd done just
what
the same
was your
thing.
Position in the column?
Pretty well to the back. We were with the rear party. Those two columns went out, and then Mickey Ferns had a rear party going out, and we all went through and left the defence force behind us. And so I was well at the back of the column again, and there was I don't know what was done, quite honestly, but we came back without a shot being fired over the same ground, more or less. Well, not quite. We went more west, I believe, and then came back to our dip down into the down the escarpment. But we hadn't a shot fired at us on the way back. But you can, I don't know if you can really understand it, that you're boiling by this time. You're more or less in a permanent sweat, because you know that it can happen at any time. I suppose it's fear in a sense, but
Did you have a feeling that time was running out for you, in a sense?
You do get this sort of feeling, and especially when you're tired. But you do get to the stage where it doesn't matter.
When you say you're in a sweat, does that actually mean you were sweating?
Or you're just sweat with fear, I think, because we're just driving, more or less, and night. The nights can be cold, you know. After the heat of the day, the nights can be quite cold. In fact, quite often we used to wear the greatcoats at night. It takes believing that it's so hot through the day, yet the nights can be so cold. In fact, in some places on the desert, I did mention it with the jock columns, you get a frost, a very heavy dew anyway, not always a frost, but a very heavy dew. The night can be very, very cold, especially after the heat of the day. Now, it was more, I think, we're sweating with, I would say sweating, we're clammy with fear. And yet fear isn't really the word I want to use, because we weren't, we were past caring as far as that went. We didn't, we've always said if your name's on the bullet, well, it's there. That's the end of it. This happens. You just get hardened to it. You see so many of your friends going that you just get hardened to this sort of situation. Fear is entirely the wrong word.
What were your feelings on and those of the men about you on this action, which appeared to be just in and out?
Well, we were told, you see, that it had been a successful action because we had got the 10th Indian Division out. So,
but your own losses have been quite heavy, have they?
We'd lost quite a few, especially the carriers. You see, we went out with intention of shooting. For all, we weren't taking any really heavy stuff with us. We had the anti-tank with us in case we were attacked to repel tanks or armoured cars or things like that. But we went out with the intention of shooting, and the second Cheshires, they had quite a good time because they were in trucks. But carriers on the outside, and they were really exploring the countryside as far as they could. It was a moonlight night, I think. Yeah, moonlight. And you could see fairly well. And, you know, there's always, when you're travelling on the desert, there's always a dust rising. Even when you've got a heavy dew, there's still a dust rising. But you know that you can smell you're in the right sort of track. You know, you can tell that you're in the right area. But the carriers, they were darting around all over and looking for trouble, obviously. Unfortunately, one or two of them found it.
Was there any anger at being used in this way?
I don't think so.
Particularly at the end of the action when you saw your losses, isn't it?
You see, I think the soldier has a great faith in his officers, right to the top. I think he has great faith in his officers. And I mean, if the soldier hasn't any faith in him, it's no good having an officer, is it? Because he's the man who's got to instill the faith. It's him who's got to act properly and do his job properly. And if the soldier's got no faith in his officers, well, it's just not going to work at all, is it? I mean, we know of a case where some soldiers were sent to another theatre of war when they should have been sent over to join their own units who were preparing for the Northwest Frontier. And they did lose faith in their officers because they'd been lied to. They were told they were going home. Instead of that, they finished in another fighting area.
Which particular case was this?
Well, it was a case where after you've been wounded for 6 weeks, or even if the unit has moved away some considerable distance, then you're going to a pool, just like a labour pool. It can be a pool of infantry, a pool of machine gunners, or a pool of men. Just like you've got a vehicle pool, you can go there and draw people out. Well, this particular bunch of lads, they were 50 division lads. It was later on, in fact, it was after Sicily, I think. And they were told that they were going to go home and rejoin the 50 Div to prepare for the Northwest Frontier in Europe. But instead of that, they were sent to Italy. And they were sort of lied to. In fact, they were told one thing and sent somewhere else. And they did go on strike. But this was a case where it wasn't their officers that had done this. This was probably, somebody said that there weren't so many soldiers now.
Did you know some of
them? Not personally, no. No, but I knew of it. I knew it had happened.
Were you, as the other ranks, satisfied with the way that your officers had performed during this retreat and this action?
Oh, I think so. Because even looking back at it now, it wasn't the fault of the infantry. It was really the fault that we didn't have an anti-tank gun. This was a great thing. And there was one thing, possibly, that our, maybe the army commander or the corps commanders hadn't got the grips with the way the Germans had, and that was to sort of draw tanks onto their anti-tank guns. And we didn't see this at all. I mean, we were still doing the cavalry charges where a horse and a man went out and they fought a horse and a man. The fact that one horse had a 2-pound gun and the other had a 6-pound gun, that didn't sort of grip our commanders. And there was a slight fault there, I think, and we did feel this.
Did you have this feeling at this time?
Yes. Even now, I mean, we were still fighting with a 2-pounder anti-tank gun. True enough, the artillery by now had got a 6-pound anti-tank gun. But really speaking, the only anti-tank gun that we had any faith in was the 25-pounder. And that wasn't an anti-tank gun, that was an artillery piece. But that was the only one we had any faith in as far as anti-tank work went. Yes, we had this feeling that we had been let down. But we also knew that the terrific amount of stuff was going to Russia.
And this was well known at the time.
This was well known because we'd been up on this run into Turkey. I did explain that we'd been into Turkey seeing stuff go through. So, yes, we knew that this was going on. That didn't please us too much because we always said, people who had been there before we got on the desert, said that if Wavell had had the stuff, that the North Africa would have been cleared, and that would have freed Malta, and we'd have been able to do all sorts of things then. But the stuff didn't go, it didn't happen on a lot of occasions. I think in the case of Ritchie, a lot of stuff went to Basra and up to Iraq instead of going out to support Ritchie when he was at Gazala.
At this stage, had you formed any opinions about the enemy that was facing you, with the respect or disrespect for them?
Well, we knew he could be beaten because we'd have beaten him at Arras. You know, we bloodied his nose for him properly at Arras, and so we knew that he wasn't any different to us as far as that went, provided the equipment was on terms. And we knew that we didn't have the right anti-tank in particular, we didn't have the right tanks.
Did it make you feel angry or despair, the fact that you know you were fighting with, in effect, one hand tied behind your back?
Well, when I was out with Apple Column at Gazala, on the east of the box, we're talking with Bill Handel, sat there looking down at the battle going on. We thought we were winning hands down, because we saw the tanks driving forward, but what we didn't see was the anti-tank guns over the ridge. So when the tanks drove forward, I mean, they were straight on top of the anti-tank guns, but we didn't see that. And of course, we did sort of expect the tanks going back. If they were going forward, we expected to go forward and follow them.
Was there a feeling growing, as some commentators have said, that you felt that Rommel was invincible?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. No, because we were harassing Rommel all the time at Gazala. You know, I mean, all any harassment was done from our side. There was very little from his side. And, no, we weren't.
So your feelings then were that given
on equal terms,
equipment, tanks, you could beat them.
Yes.
Did you have any feeling that you may ever get them?
There was a doubt about this, because everything had to come around the Cape, and there's some doubt as to whether we would it arrive in time. That was a big problem. We thought it would come, because we were hearing from our radio reports, you know, we had radios tuned into I don't know where it came from now. Well, probably from the Middle East. But we were getting sort of radio reports. And we knew that a lot of stuff was going to Russia. And we knew about the Baltic convoys. So we knew that a lot of stuff was going to Russia. And we appreciated that Russia was in a problem because Stalingrad was just, I think it was just about the time that Stalingrad was on the go. And we realised that Russia had to be backed to give a pincer movement, a proper pincer movement. So, yes, we realised that this had to go on. And, no, I don't think there was any real worry in that score.